Welcome to Virtual Economy, a podcast about the business of games for the rest of us. We're your hosts. I'm Amanda Farrow.
And I'm Michael Footer.
Each episode will cover the biggest business beats and bring in expert commentary from lawyers, analysts, and industry pros.
And I am excited because we are going to have one of our favorite pros on the show after the break.
A literal analyst.
A literal analyst.
And a literal pro.
And a literal pro. But before we get there, and before Matt Piscatella from NPD joins us later today, we got some news.
We do have some news.
Yeah. We're going to close the loop on a story we covered, I believe it was last week.
It was last week. Time is a flat circle.
Lab Zero, which was the developer working on Skullgirls.
But did not own the IP.
The IP was owned by Autumn Games.
Yep.
And there was also another studio working on the mobile version of the game. I think it's Hidden Variable is the name of the studio.
I think so.
Lab Zero, whose founder is the sole owner of the company, Mike Zaymont, who goes by Mike Z, did some not great stuff, and it caused an exodus from the company. It caused Autumn Games to part ways. Lab Zero has now laid off the rest of its employees.
Great.
Yeah.
Cool and great. Where was Lab Zero located? Do we know?
I'm looking at Kotaku covered this story. We have the link in the show notes. I don't know where Lab Zero was located. That is a really good question.
We'll just put it in the show notes when we figure it out. I just thought about this because they're later in the show we're going to talk about an enormous round of layoffs that ended up hitting.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up right now. So essentially, what happened here is Lab Zero lost the ability to continue developing its ongoing game Skullgirls, and
well, because so many of the key people ended up leaving.
Yes. Well, and then Autumn Games pulled the list. They're in LA, by the way.
Oh, they're in LA.
They're in LA. So essentially, in the Kotaku story, Kotaku managed to get a comment from Zaymont.
Oh, boy.
Quote, unfortunately, Lab Zero was forced into layoffs because we were no longer able to meet our payroll obligations. It's not a decision I made lightly. I personally know how hard it can be to find employment in a poorly performing economy, but we have more debt than cash. And the last thing I would ever do is not pay my hardworking colleagues or our partners for their work. We're exploring all funding options in hopes of bringing those team members back, but right now that's the reality. And in an email blast to the company, to the employees, Zaymont told them to keep on the lookout for something about severance. But as of this publication, which went up yesterday at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, there was no information about that. So hopefully the employees will get something. But yeah, this is a crummy... So the situation here, let's just walk through it real quick. Mike Zaymont does some really bad stuff.
Yes.
Employees then are forced into a terrible decision. Do we stick around and keep our mouths shut, or do we be brave and speak up and leave, which is what they did?
Yes.
And you know, huge thanks and gratitude to those people at the company who did speak up and leave.
Yeah.
You know, and then, of course, they lost the right to continue making the game that made them famous.
Mm-hmm.
And now you've got more people out of work. It is a crummy situation, but it all has to be traced back
exactly
to Mike Zaymont's actions.
Yeah, absolutely. And he has to take responsibility for that. And it really does seem like he's taking exactly zero responsibility.
It does. So that is the latest beat in that story. But we have more.
We do have more. So on... So Vlambeer is 10.
Yes.
And on its 10th anniversary, co-founders Rami Ismail and, my goodness, I've never been able to pronounce his name.
Jan Willem Nyman.
There we go. See, there we go.
If I'm right, it could be Jan.
Jan. I assume
sure
that
Jan.
It's not. I assume that it's not.
Yeah, I'm sure it's JW is what he goes by.
JW is what he goes by, which is why it was shocking for me to see it like spelled out like that. So anyway. So yesterday being Thursday.
Or was it Wednesday?
Maybe it was Wednesday.
Look, time is a flat circle, folks.
Yeah, it's not a good time. So Vlambeer just ended up celebrating 10 years, and the two co-founders, Rami and JW, announced that they are parting ways.
Yes, and they are not... They jokingly call themselves one half of Vlambeer. There are other people who worked with Vlambeer.
Of course, it's a fairly sizable team.
Yep, but they decided this was an opportunity. They have done everything they set out to do
as a team. Yeah,
and we're going to see more from Rami. I'm sure we'll see more from JW and the other members of that team.
Absolutely.
There was a statement that they issued in a multi-tweet thread, as is the Rami way. Today marks Blombeer's 10th anniversary, which is way longer than we could have ever imagined. We had a beautiful run, made incredible games, and worked with amazing people, but it is time for new things. So we're announcing the end of Blombeer. So just so you know, they are still working on Ultra Bugs. Ultra Bugs will come out. I saw that at PAX East 2 years ago?
I think it was 2 years
ago. So not this past PAX East, but because I ended up in a long conversation with Rami right by their booth and played it. It was really good.
Yeah.
It's important to know, it's not a sad day for us, but the happy conclusion to a whirlwind decade filled with screen shake. It feels like we've achieved what we set out to do as a studio, as a voice, and as individuals, and we are extremely grateful for these past years. And if you don't follow Rami, Rami's an amazing follow. Please follow Rami. But he's been doing some really interesting streams. He's been mapping out flight simulator routes.
Yes.
And that has been in a window on his screen while he's been playing something else. And I can't remember what he's been playing.
He also got locked out of his apartment partway through one of them, which is really funny.
Oh no, how many souls were aboard that aircraft?
I don't even know.
Probably not many because of COVID. Oh. Hey-o! Travel, remember that, folks?
And that was the gallows humor for today.
Yep.
So in celebration of new beginnings.
New beginnings.
Of new beginnings, because that's how I'm choosing to look at things. In a celebration of new beginnings, Blombeer is going to be holding a Steam sale.
Yep, that's going on right now, I believe.
Absolutely. And they released a prototype for a game called Flood.
Crinkle, crinkle. ASMR.
Okay, if you don't understand that reference, you should hang out with us sometime for Ready Player Mom After Dark.
We played Revengers last night, and it was so much fun. And I was playing as Hulk, and I was doing, like, Hulk role play, but Hulk ends up sounding like Cookie Monster when I do it.
Yes.
So now it's, like, Cookie Monster / Hulk ASMR. I put the phone, like, the mic real close to my mouth, and I just do, like, Hulk ASMR. Hulk not think you're puny. Hulk think you best. Crinkle, crinkle.
Crinkle, crinkle. Anyway, all that to say, they released a prototype for a game called FF Flood. In all caps.
All caps.
So that's what's going on with Blombeer. Best of luck to JW, to Rami, to the team as they continue to make cool games. I can't wait to see what's next for each of them.
Yes. Speaking of things that are next.
I'm sorry, you mean things that never were?
This is how I wrote this in the show notes. It's almost official. The never public Warner Brothers Interactive sale is not publicly not happening. So new reports, this one from Bloomberg.
Wait a second. One more time for the cheap seats.
It's almost official. The never public Warner Brothers Interactive sale is not publicly not happening.
God, everything about that is a lot. All right, so there have been more reports. So...
Yeah, so these came out of Bloomberg as well.
Yes.
Sale has apparently been canceled, which does follow some strong statements of affirmation that were made during the last earnings call about how Warner Brothers Interactive Games was still part of its division.
Right, exactly. And we talked about that, I think, in our last episode because earnings for Warner Brothers had come out.
Again, I don't remember if that was last episode or the episode, but it was within the last couple of weeks.
I think so. Yeah. Maybe it wasn't last week.
That was
week.
Also when WB laid off a large number of people, including some high-up people at DC.
Yeah, that was a couple of weeks ago.
Reprioritized right. HBO Max and making that a key part of its strategy. We suspect that DC Universe is going to change in some way. I don't think they're going to completely sunset it.
No.
But it could turn into more of a Marvel Unlimited type situation.
Yeah, it's going to be more. I have a feeling that it's going to end up being more of a digital expression of their analog products. So we're going to see lots more comics. But I have a feeling that all of their television shows are going to end up moving over to HBO Max, which is good because we can just watch it on HBO Max.
Yeah, so that's Harley Quinn, the Harley Quinn cartoon, which is amazing. That's Titans, which we're actually watching right now, which is very violent.
It's a lot. I should go watch Teen Titans.
Yeah, that's Young Justice, which could move over. That's Doom Patrol.
Right.
It's
a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff right there. And there's all of the DC animated movies, which seem like fractured across DC Universe. And Hulu, and Netflix, and HBO Max right now. It's very strange.
It's very convoluted. So, like, the report, which was by Nabila Ahmed and Scott Moritz, goes a little bit more into what the underpinnings of that sale were starting to look like.
So remember, this report came out. There's some additional color in the Bloomberg report suggesting that AT&T was working with Liontree Advisors to explore the potential sale. We knew that Microsoft, Take-Two, EA, and Activision were potentially interested in that. And we've heard that from sources as well.
Yeah, it's true.
About some of these companies.
Yeah.
So there was a change in senior leadership at AT&T. In July, Chief Operating Officer John Stankey took over as Chief Executive Officer after Randall Stephenson left that role, remaining chairman. So it could be a change in leadership that has led to the different perspective.
I think that what partially ended up happening there is they realized just how lucrative video games are.
Yeah. And
specifically WBIE, because there are some great studios that are doing some really cool things, especially from a licensing perspective.
Mm-hmm. And we now know Gotham Knights is a thing. And we know that Suicide Squad is a thing. And although Suicide Squad is still a year and a half out, maybe more.
At least.
Gotham Knights we're going to see next year.
Yeah, exactly.
Probably. Again, we don't know how the long-term effect of the pandemic and how long.
But I want Babs in my veins.
Yeah.
Babs looks great. So instead, AT&T may now be looking to sell DirecTV, Xandr, which is a digital advertising unit, and potentially Crunchyroll.
Yeah.
Which is surprising to me because Crunchyroll has become so popular, mm-hmm. especially in the United States, because anime is enjoying, you know, more mainstream attention than it ever has. So that's surprising to me because I would imagine that Crunchyroll, both the subscription service and their merchandising, it probably nets them some serious cash.
Sure, but at the same time, they could probably sell for a lot of money to another streaming company that could fold it in.
Like Funimation?
Yes.
Yeah. That would probably, I mean, but yeah, that's probably their best bet.
Yeah. So just to close this out, AT&T purchased Time Warner in 2018 for $85 billion.
Right.
And they have a lot of debt right now between that purchase and the DirecTV purchase. So it could be a way to mitigate debt.
Yeah.
And that could be their primary goal here. Again, shift in leadership, shift in priorities.
Yeah, that's always going to be the case. Speaking of leadership and broken things. Oh, boy. Okay, so Ubisoft screwed up again. A lot.
Something I don't even have in these show notes that we're going to throw in there as well.
If it's the thing I think we're...
Oh, it is.
Okay.
It is.
That's nice. Okay, so so things around Tom Clancy's Elite Squad mobile game always looked a little bit janky and weird. We watched the last Ubisoft Forward, because of course we did, and we saw the trailer, and it looked like Sam Fisher was teaming up with El Sueño from...
Man, that just feels weird, because...
El Sueño is a very bad character, like an extremely racist character.
Yeah, like, it's like he's a caricature, and it's like, we played Wildlands, like, El Sueño... the white man. It's like, it was this very caricature.
It was so bad. It was so deeply racist. And I absolutely despised Wildlands.
Yeah.
And I've had a really tough time as a result trying to get back into Ghost Recon because maybe those games are just not for me. So anyway, we got to see more about it recently. And let's talk about it. So in an opening sequence that introduces the story and the setting,
mm-hmm.
we learn about the anarchist group Umbra, which we're told is taking advantage of societal unrest to destabilize the government. Notably, the sequence associates Umbra with a stylized raised black fist, imagery that, as we know, is typically associated with the Black Power movement, and more recently, the image has come to be associated with Black Lives Matter.
Yep.
Oh my God. They so incredibly stepped in it.
So, Tom Clancy was a conservative.
Yes. And don't get me wrong, I like The Division.
Mm-hmm. But The Division is also that power fantasy of, you are secretly an agent living amongst the plebs. And now you are activated. You're called into action. Like, look, I loved running around in New York in The Division.
What, like, for me, it was more of like this, not a celebration, but when I played it, it felt like, well, now I get to help people.
Yes.
That's how I read it.
Well, and that's, and again.
And maybe that's a cultural thing, because if I think about it from like a Canadian perspective, that's mm-hmm. the way that I would have interpreted it had I been called as a division agent of like, oh, okay, yeah, I've been training for this my whole life, and now I get to go out and actually do what I was trained to do, which is help people and save them and you know, make sure that they're okay and help get things back on track and like do the things that are necessary to make sure that people are okay.
Right. And at the
but
same
I'm a
time,
Pollyanna.
Well, and at the same time, like being very close to New York, it's like, we're helping our city. We're helping the people who live near us. And
that's
there was that, like, I'm running around and it was probably the great, you know, one of the, my greatest video game joys was running around New York. And yes, it's a very condensed New York.
Well, it was
like running from Chelsea to the post office across from,
oh, I'm sorry,
from Penn Station in 5 minutes is hilarious.
Taking like 2 seconds because that is not how New York is set up. Well, that was even before I moved here.
Yep.
You know, I came here for a visit and the division came out shortly thereafter. And I was like, oh my goodness, I've been here.
Well, and when I went up to the city, I took a couple of pictures around Penn Station, and there is this alley that's not far from Penn Station that's like perfectly, or this like courtyard area that's perfectly modeled in the division, and it was just really cool.
Anyway, so we love the original Division game because it's reminiscent of we are going to save New York, which has become my city,
mm-hmm.
even though it wasn't always the case.
So, but this whole thing of like, oh, you have this group who's actually, you know, covertly manipulating a political unrest and social disobedience.
Oh my God.
At this point, it's just so tone deaf. So Ubisoft
It's not just tone deaf. That's straight up a problem.
Yeah. Well, it's, first of all, it's appropriation.
Yes.
And second of all, it is this, it's conspiracy nonsense, right? Because there is conspiracy about Black Lives Matter that, oh, Black Lives Matter is actually not, is really, you know, that's not really its purpose. Its purpose is to...
No, it's literally its purpose.
I know.
It's Black liberation. Like,
so, God. Ubisoft kind of apologized in a statement.
Kinda.
Well, and I say kinda, and we'll talk about this.
This is barely an apology.
Yeah. Imagery that appeared in the opening video sequence of Tom Clancy's Elite Squad featuring a raised fist was insensitive and harmful in both its inclusion and how it was portrayed. We have listened to and appreciate the players and the broader community who have pointed it out, and we apologize. The raised fist image was since removed. They changed the opening movie. But the whole premise is...
The premise is the bad thing.
Is that, oh, social justice isn't really social justice. It's manipulated by other people. So if you're a patsy if you believe in social justice.
And who was in charge of this?
And that was the other point that I was... My understanding is this is a studio head, very young. And let me see if I can pronounce his name right. It's Charlie... Is that Guillemot? Yeah, he's Eve's son.
So, that is an enormous problem in and of itself. And in addition to this, it's important to note that Ubisoft only came out and made this very small change, by the way. It is a small change. And it's an aesthetic change, not a narrative underpinnings change, but an aesthetic change.
Mm-hmm.
And there were people internally that were screaming about this. I almost guarantee that. I almost guarantee that there were people working at a number of different Ubisoft studios that were like, what are you guys doing? You cannot do this. This is not okay. You know, because, yes, they do have so many problems at Ubisoft with people being harassed, but they do have an extremely diverse they have extremely diverse development teams across a number of studios. It's not as though they were being silent. It's that they were silenced.
So
until the broader community was like, bro.
Yeah. So Jason Schreier, who is at Bloomberg now, tweeted this on August 31st.
Right.
The director of this game and manager of the studio behind it is Charlie Guillemot. If that name sounds familiar, it's because his father is Yves Guillemot, Ubisoft CEO. Charlie Guillemot graduated university in 2014 and became studio manager in 2014. Nepotism is a hell of a drug.
And while we joke about that, we joked about that in our interview earlier this week with the two co-founders of Eggnut, Alex and Nikita, it wasn't serious. Nepotism is bad.
It is.
It's extremely bad. And it's not about the meritocracy. It's about ensuring that you are looking at a broad range of voices and backgrounds and you are finding the right skill sets in addition to the right personalities. You've got a vibe. Right?
Yep.
That's what Alex said, is you've got a vibe. And we could have a whole friggin' discussion and bring a round table of panelists to talk about hiring practices.
Absolutely.
But Ubisoft is making stupid decisions as per usual.
And we can look forward to them not addressing this on September 10th at their next Ubisoft Forward, which will take place at 3 p.m. Eastern.
Great. 5 days from now.
Yep.
Good times.
And I want to throw this in because I think it's important to this conversation about the way... because Ubisoft and Activision have both been guilty of this, and they're not the only ones, by
the
way.
Oh, goodness, no.
Where, oh, our games aren't political. We don't have political messages in our games. So Activision, at the same time, if you happen to watch the Gamescom Opening Night Live cutscene with that was taken from Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War, which is a direct sequel to Call of Duty Black Ops 1, it was, you got to see Ronald Reagan.
Ew. That was gross. Don't ever use that voice again. I don't like it.
And it's like glorifying war crimes. Like right now. Oh, and promoting an alt-right conspiracy. Again, there was a Kotaku story about that. About how this whole game, it's yikes. It's yikes city. Like right now, this is what you're doing?
It is maximum oof.
Yeah. Now, I know that these games are in development for a while. On the Ubisoft side, because games are in development long before the public sees them, even though these people who cause so many problems inside Ubisoft are gone, we're going to feel those effects for years. It's why we saw, like, it took so long for us to start seeing inclusion and diversity work its way in, especially after 2014, because there were games that were in development. It was harder to change course.
Especially
so
for larger projects.
Time.
Yeah.
And, yeah, especially for larger projects where you're steering an aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm.
For smaller projects, for indies, no. I mean, these are pivots that can be more easily made.
Yes, because your teams are much smaller.
So hopefully, I don't think we're going to start seeing the new Ubisoft in terms of the way it's affected the product for 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years at least. We will see. But the other portion of this, you know, kind of building on that,
mm-hmm.
is one of the things you and I saw in Wasteland 3 was there was a message at the beginning of the game.
Oh, yeah. This was really good. Kudos to InXile and Deep Silver for this.
Yeah, this was really smart. They had this screen that said, hey, check it out. We didn't mean for this to happen, but we recognize that the current political climate is kind of similar to this, and we're feeling this too. So
just to give you a little bit of, like, just the beginning of the game, you play about an hour, and then you meet the Patriarch, who is essentially in charge of Colorado. And the Patriarch has two sons and a daughter who are very prominent in political life and who are now conspiring against him. And it's very rah-rah America. In fact, the Patriarch's weapon of choice is this giant warhammer that's made from a fist of a statue. And, you know,
it's got like an American flag wrapped around it or something like that. I don't even know. It is a wonderful satire.
It
honestly is.
It's satire in the vein of the original Fallout and Fallout 2.
Yes, and that's why...
Smart, pointed satire.
Which is why I really enjoyed the original Fallout and the original Fallout 2. So
the later Fallout games still have that tongue-in-cheek consumerism thing that Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 had, but Fallout 1 and Fallout 2 were written in such a way that it was biting sarcasm.
It was. That's where I learned a lot of my enjoyable wordplay as a child.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. I was probably too young to play that game. That's okay. I turned out fine.
You turned out fine.
Okay. What time is it, Mike?
It is not actually time for that. We're going to move stuff around.
Oh,
we're
going to
do
darn
Big
it.
Fish.
Okay.
And then we're
going
to do that thing, and I'll sing for you because I know you love it.
Okay. Well, it's hard to keep track of you sometimes. Okay. Fine. Let's talk about what happened at Big Fish. So Big Fish went through a significant round of layoffs.
Huge.
Significant. We are talking approximately 50% of the company, 250 people were recently laid off within the last few days. The company itself is 18 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It was founded in Seattle in 2002. It is mostly a casino. I don't know.
Actually, I'm not sure if it was founded in Seattle or not. Let me check that because I think they're in a bunch of different places.
Okay.
I'm checking. This is why I use the iPad when we're doing this.
Yeah, so that you guys don't have to hear the clicky clackies of my keyboard. But anyway, the important thing about this is that this was a significant round of layoffs during a time where layoffs are very bad. And especially in Seattle, which is an extremely expensive city to live in as it is. It is a game development hub, but so many companies are struggling to make things work in Seattle right now. So many companies.
You were correct. It was based and founded in Seattle. Okay. They have a regional office in Oakland. I knew there was one other office.
Right. Got it. So just to give a little bit of color here, I'll give you some context and then Mike will walk you through what happened. So in 2014, Big Fish was sold to Churchill Downs, which is a racetracks and casinos company in Kentucky.
Yes.
The deal was worth approximately $855 million. That's a decent amount of money. Mm-hmm. 4 years later, in 2018, Big Fish was sold to Australian slot machine maker Aristocrat Leisure for $990 million. But also later that year, they laid off 15% of their workforce.
Yep. Yeah.
So
which isn't terribly uncommon when you've got a sale or an acquisition that happens. Yep. Because the new owners always want to streamline and see where they can cut costs, even if they don't take the time to understand the organization.
Yeah, and it's the same kind of thing in the lead up to IPOs. And we talked about Unity's IPO, upcoming IPO. So it wouldn't be surprising to me if they ended up laying off people.
Especially because Unity, just to reflect real quickly, Unity we know is not profitable.
Exactly. So I would not surprise me if Unity went through a small round of layoffs at some point over the next 18 months. So Big Fish Games recently had to settle two class action lawsuits surrounding gambling in its games.
Mm-hmm.
Past and current owners would pay $155 million under these settlements, but apparently job cuts are not connected.
That's what they said. They said that this is about streamlining for the future as opposed to...
They're trying to gussy themselves up for another sale.
Probably, if I had to guess. I mean, look, when we talked about the Activision layoffs and the EA layoffs, we talked about the fact that There are multiple threads of conversation that happen around layoffs.
Yes.
How do you handle your layoffs? Are you a human being like EA?
Yes.
Or are you a lizard person like Activision?
That's very true. So let's walk through this. What happened?
So Churchill Downs is going to have to pay $124 million of that $155, and Aristocrat's going to have to pay $31 million. Big Fish, GeekWire happened to grab a copy of the internal memo that was sent out about all of this and the reasons for the sales. And we dropped the link into the show notes.
Yeah.
And then this was, quote, to strengthen our business and position Big Fish for long-term success. Now, Big Fish makes, as you can probably guess by who owns them and the reasons why they were settling lawsuits, they make casino games.
They do make casino games, which is what I said earlier in the conversation.
Yeah, this is gaming with a capital G.
Yeah, this is gaming with a capital G, and it's not, it's a little shady in some places, but they have other kinds of games. They have like time management games and they have different kinds of sim games as well.
Yeah.
So I don't know what they look like because those kinds of games are not for me, but the vast majority of them are mobile.
Yes. So here is what else was in the statement, in the internal memo that GeekWire got their hands on. Quote, the scale that Big Fish developed over many years as a multi-platform publisher has made it difficult to successfully lead in mobile, which requires greater agility and different operating and creative capabilities. Now, we're going to stop there and break that down just a little bit.
Yeah.
What that means is they got too diverse, and they weren't able to focus in their core competency, which is mobile.
Yeah.
So
when we talk about diversity in this particular
operational diversity as opposed to
human resources
diversity, yeah. By pivoting how we operate and sharpening focus, we'll gain increased flexibility to engage players more effectively today and invest more for the future. Again, this is about focusing on their core competency of mobile.
Which is what NCSoft?
Yeah, when they closed their OC office.
When they closed their Orange County office, that's what they were saying, is that they needed to focus on their core competencies. And this is the same kind of thing. They got too broad when they need to go deep.
Yes. We're making these changes proactively from a position of financial strength. So again, this is them reinforcing that we're not scrambling here.
That's still 50%. That's not a small layoff.
It's true. So we're talking 250 people, 50% of their staff. This is a huge layoff.
That's almost as many as EA laid off in 2019,
yes.
Was it?
Mm-hmm. And also, but at least they're upfront and saying like, hey, we know we're in a strong financial position right now. This isn't about where we are right now. This is where we are for the future. And it's something I wish that I think would have behooved Activision especially to address head on and be like, hey, we know the optics on this. We know the optics are that we're laying people off when times are good for us, and we need to explain that so that people understand what's going on.
This is just, and so, yes, they're making this from a position of financial strength. They're looking to reduce certain costs, but saving money is not the primary driver. Instead, they're looking to be more effective and customer-centric. However, that is not going to balm how much this is going to hurt the people that have been laid off especially in a lousy economy.
A lousy economy in Seattle, which is not an inexpensive place to live.
No, it's extremely expensive.
Now, the good news is there are a lot of studios in Seattle.
It is a game development hub.
Mm-hmm. But again, we're in the middle of a miserable economy, a global pandemic, and
country that does not have its poop in a group.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's good. I feel like the timing on this is really bad for 250 people.
Yeah, it's really bad. And you can understand this from an operational perspective and be like, okay, I see what you're doing. I can appreciate that. This is for long-term success. And at the same time, it's just like the pricing conversation that we had last week about video game price increases.
Yep.
Is it really the time?
Yeah.
Is now really the time?
Yeah. And you and I have talked about that a lot. And I think that being sensitive to the market with a little M and the market with a big M.
Yeah.
And understanding, what people are going through. Remember, people make your products. People consume your products.
Business is not about just about the numbers. Mm-hmm. It is about the people. And the more that we can hammer that home, especially here on this show,
mm-hmm.
I would be glad to continue to do that. Business is about people. Yes, it is about money. Yes, it is about serving consumers and serving the market. But it's about people first and foremost.
Absolutely.
Your people.
All right. Well, with that, it's time for Quick Hits.
We should just start recording this on video. All right.
And we will not play Pudgy Bunny
ever again.
You can hit us up on Twitter if you missed the stream last night about why we will never be doing that again.
Gross. Okay.
We're going to jump to B. Early. We're going to save A for our conversation with Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So we're going to preface this with a content warning. We've talked about this before on previous conversations, specifically when we were chatting with Kate Sanchez. This is about Hassan Bokhari, who was a nefarious figure at Twitch and constantly abused his position of power to get favors from women who were trying to make Twitch partners.
Yep.
So thankfully, however, Bokhari has been banned from Twitch and has been separated from the company. Bokhari was the former director of strategic partnerships and, as I previously said, abused his position to make inappropriate advances on women. That is a very, very, very light way of putting it.
Yep.
I am not close with some of the women that he did this to, but I know them well enough to know the damage that was done. His separation mm-hmm. comes after over a month of investigation.
Yeah. And I want to talk about the use of the word separation, because I wrote that in the show notes. And it's one of those things where sometimes you learn the easy way and sometimes you learn the hard way about why somebody leaves a company, the official reason that somebody left a company. And we talked about this around the Ubisoft stuff as well, like who was allowed to leave and who was fired. Separation is kind of just a catch-all term.
Yes.
And we don't know exactly what went down here. If look, on the surface, it appears that he was fired.
That's very surface level.
But we can't come out and say he was fired unless somebody makes an official statement or he comes out and says, I was fired. So using the word separation is more just a reporting for me, and I suspect for you as well, a
Certainly.
Reporting standard where it's like, hey, we want to make sure that we are not stating something that we don't know for a fact.
Exactly. So that's our catch-all term there, and it was good of you to explain that, because it's not us trying to soften the language.
Yeah, and that's what I was worried about, and that's why I wanted to bring it up.
Yeah, it's not about softening the language. It's about It's about making sure that we are getting our facts straight.
Yes.
All right. So what else happened?
So Microsoft may have a second console. You may have heard of this non-console. So it's like the WB sale. This is the not public, not announced.
The Xbox Series S, otherwise known as Extra Small Small,
which was the funniest thing. So big ups to Extra Small Small. So the Xbox Series S, which is Project Lockhart.
Yes.
That was the code name. And now we kind of assume that we know the name because there are a couple things. Remember, we talked about how there were controllers that were leaked into the wild with the street date of November 6th. And they actually said they were Xbox Series X controllers. They were the new ones that had three function buttons on the front. Yes. Share button, I guess, what is now.
The share button is so smart, though. I'm so happy they're putting a share button on there.
Did you know, technically, the left button on the Xbox One thing is the share button?
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah. That was like the share slash streaming button.
Oh.
So.
It's not, it's
It's
not,
like, so both PlayStation, yeah. the DualShock 4 and they changed that whole back and, select and start.
Right.
Like, convention to share and options. Both of them this generation. And everybody's looking at it like, why you gotta mess with it, man?
Yeah, why you gotta do the thing? Like, could you not? Like, for 10 minutes, could you not?
So, those boxes from those controllers actually said Xbox Series S on them.
Yes, they did.
And now, someone purchased a new Xbox One controller. Now, remember, all of the Xbox One official peripherals and the ones that are officially licensed by Microsoft are going to carry forward to the Xbox Series X and Series S, I guess.
Extra small.
Including our Astro headsets, which I'm really excited about.
Oh, yeah, that's going to be great. All we need to do is attach an HDMI cable to
But that's on the PS5. It's just the PS5 that needs that HDMI pass-through. And I think that's for the 3D audio.
I'm still okay with that. Yeah. I want to go back and listen to Mark Cerny's ASMR again.
And if you already have an Astro headset, you can get like a $15 discount on the $40 HDMI adapter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty great.
Anyway.
So someone purchased and took pictures of, they purchased a new Xbox One controller and it came with a Game Pass Unlimited trial. And ours did too. When I bought my Xbox Elite controller version 2, it came mm-hmm. with one of these slips, right?
Yes, it did.
And I went back and looked and I was so afraid, like, oh my gosh, did I miss something obvious on here? Our slip did not say this, but the slip that came with this Xbox One controller that this person purchased, and I know Eurogamer covered this story,
mm-hmm.
actually said Xbox Series S on it.
Weird.
It said Xbox Series X and Xbox Series S.
That's just
so
weird.
So we'll talk about this with Matt in just a little bit.
Yes.
Why? Just announce it? It's September.
We'll get there. Buckle up. It's going to be a conversation and a half.
What else do we have here?
We had some stuff, like Nintendo is doing some shenanigans.
Nintendo's doing a Nintendo.
Nintendo is being the weirdo as per usual. Nintendo gets away with so much because everyone's like, what is Nintendo doing? And everyone's like, I don't know, Nintendo got a Nintendo.
Nintendo's just sitting there going, it's fine.
It's cool, it's fine, don't worry about it.
You know who Nintendo is? If you've seen Mythic Quest, he's, Nintendo.
He totally is.
Nintendo is the creative director in that studio. It's fine.
It's fine.
It's fine.
Don't worry about it.
It'll be fine.
It'll be okay.
Just do it.
Just do the thing. That's gross and weird, and I don't like it. Mythic Quest is really funny, though. That's an Ubisoft thing, but it is funny as heck. So anyway, Nintendo has apparently relaxed its pre-purchase policy because its former pre-purchase policy was completely draconian.
It was the SOL policy. Oh, you pre-purchase this game and need your money back?
Oh,
you're SOL, pal.
Yeah. You are 100% SOL. Anyway, it was draconian as heck and not super sensitive for consumers. So anyway, you can now cancel for a refund if there is more than a week before the game's release. I think that's great.
I think that's fair. I think at that point they start payment processing and it's understandable.
Absolutely. I would tend to agree. Speaking of Nintendo.
Oh, Nintendo!
Nintendo, the limited run of Super Mario 3D All-Stars?
Okay, and it's not limited run the company. Not Josh
limited.
And Dougie, we love you.
Not limited run TM.
So, there was a surprise direct yesterday. In that we kind of knew this was coming. There have been lots of rumors.
Surprise.
In fact, Andy Robinson at VGC reminded that they were the first to break the Super Mario 3D All-Stars story months ago.
In March.
Good on you, Andy. Well done. So there were a number of new things that were announced. And we're going to run through off the top of my head real quick. So coming in February of next year,
mm-hmm.
Super Mario 3D Land plus Bowser's Fury getting a Switch release.
That is going to be extremely exciting.
Including,
I will buy that.
Including two Kid Cat amiibos, Cat Mario and Cat Peach, and I did pre-order them both. I'll put, Cat Mario on my desk and you can have Cat Peach on your desk.
Cat Peach is going to have to hang out with one of my Sailor Scouts,
You do have some great amiibo.
I really do.
You have made some good choices. I should open up that Loot Goblin and put the Loot Goblin on your desk too.
Oh my god, that Loot Goblin is too much.
Yep.
Yes, I have a lot of cool toys on my desk. I really enjoy that, especially my Baby Yoda.
Let's see, there's a Game & Watch coming that runs the original Super Mario Brothers.
I know nothing about this Game & Watch.
Okay,
nothing.
So I'll run down Game & Watch real quickly. Game & Watch was a handheld series that came out. You know the Tiger Electronics games?
Mm-hmm.
Those were garbage compared to Game & Watch.
Oh, okay.
They were very similar to Game & Watch. show.
Okay. Because, like, I only
But it was, like, the
that.
Fireman, like, the fireman one where you have to catch the people, and, like, the chef one where you had to catch the egg, like, the stuff coming down in the pans.
Yeah, I think I played the chef one.
So you might recognize Mr. Game & Watch, for those of you who are too young to actually have held a Game & Watch, from his appearance in Smash.
True. That is very true.
And, in fact, with the Game & Watch amiibo, you can actually switch out the 2D... Little Mr. Game & Watch things.
Oh.
And I have that. That's a good amiibo. That's a good amiibo.
That's kind of
amiibos, Brad.
Don't get people into collecting amiibos. Don't do it. It's a bad thing.
Hey, those Monster Hunter Stories amiibo that I imported.
No, I imported.
You imported that one, but I imported the rest of them.
You did. There are four of them.
There are. And Nabiru is still in the box. Anyway, Mr. Game Watch. So Game & Watch. They were a series of handhelds.
Yes.
And now they are doing one that's full color.
Yes.
The old ones were LCD screens. So
yes.
It was just which of the little pre-made images were lit up, right?
Certainly.
With Super Mario Brothers, and it's a watch, obviously, like you can put it on your nightstand and stuff. So
sure.
it'll do alarms, it'll do all that stuff.
Okay.
All right.
That's very exciting.
So that one, based on a pre-listing, and I'm saying that because you can't order it yet, but it's like listed on Best Buy, it's only going to be $50, which is actually not that bad.
Because
I'm totally getting that.
Of
now, the thing that's going to break the bank.
Oh, this one's going to hurt.
Velen Studios. Yeah, you need at least two. Velen Studios. What is it? It's called Mario Kart.
Virtual Tour?
It's called Mario Kart Mario Kart Live Home Circuit.
Oh, Home Circuit.
It's by Velen, which is the Bala Brothers, who founded Vicarious Visions.
They're fabulous.
And I love them. I've interviewed them so many times. They are some of my favorite people.
They are absolutely fabulous humans. I'm very excited for this.
Nuha and Kartik Bala are wonderful people.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, very, very cool game that left me extremely confused and excited in equal measures.
Yeah. So, the way this thing works is you have these RC cars and that have cameras and they transmit to your Switch. So, you're seeing Mario Kart like from a close third, like it's closer than Resident Evil third person over the driver's shoulder because of the way this camera comes up. And you have these checkpoints that you put in.
Mm-hmm.
And the game somehow connects the checkpoints to make a track. Now, I don't know if you have to draw.
I don't know.
Or how that's going to work. But essentially, you turn your house into a Mario Kart track.
Which we are 100% going to do. We're going to go throw our dogs outside for a little while.
We're going to move the chairs downstairs.
Yeah. And we're going to do this in our living or in our dining room.
Yeah. Our dining room is absolutely perfect for this.
It is, yeah. It looks unbelievably fun. It's going to be stupid expensive.
Yeah, I would say that I would be shocked if these cars were $100.
Yes,
I think $100+. Maybe they'll sell them in a two set though, because you kind of need to.
You kind of need to.
And right now they're releasing Mario and Luigi, but down the road, I just
cabbage.
I just want to boo.
Aww.
I want to ride the Boo car.
You want to ride the Boo car.
I do not want to be in the Boo box, though.
No, you do not want to be in the Boo box. Okay, so there is one question, though.
There
is a question.
Do it.
Where is Mario Galaxy 2?
Okay, so to answer that question, we must investigate where Mario Galaxy 1 is. And it's coming in a release of Super Mario 3D All-Stars. Right? So it's Super Mario 64, which
yes.
is getting an up-res for Switch.
Yes.
Super Mario Sunshine.
Yes.
Which is getting an up-res for Switch and looks really good.
Looks
and Super
pretty.
Mario Galaxy. So three games.
Yes.
One cart.
Uh-huh.
Or one download.
One download.
$60.
Which is great.
$20 for these. Look, Nintendo will sell you nostalgia. Like, literally, the world will burn and Nintendo will be like, okay, but how about Super Mario Brothers, right?
Yeah,
it's good, right? You want to buy it again?
You want to buy it again like 20 years
60
later?
60 caps, man. 60 caps. That's it.
60 caps. Also, I need that goat.
Bleep, bleep. So people are asking, hey, where is Super Mario Galaxy 2? That game's rating, like, it got better reviews than Super Mario Galaxy 1. Like, I think the Metacritic's on 90, like 97 or something like that.
Yeah,
like,
it's a much, much better game.
So here's my theory. Two things. First of all, you can only purchase Super Mario 3D All-Stars until March 31st.
Okay, and that is not that's not a miscommunication on Nintendo's part. That's not us misinterpreting it. No, in fact, this is just actually a thing.
physically and digitally. It's got some real Disney Vault vibe,
right? Yeah, it's got big Disney Vault vibes. And it's frustrating because, you know, we have people that are like, okay, well, I would buy this, but I would want to buy this maybe potentially on sale or like when I have extra money or whatever.
Well, I'm telling you, we pre-ordered our copy from Best Buy immediately because we were afraid that scalpers were going to grab them all because they are doing a limited run of this.
Yes, and it's the limited, they're doing a limited print run of the physical copies, mm-hmm. especially. So it's weird. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I understand it from a business perspective because they are likely going to start parceling them out as $20 a piece or $30 a piece.
I think
piece.
It's
going to
be $30 a piece. And I think, yeah. and this is our prediction right here. We are
$29.99.
We are of like mind on this.
Yes.
That after March 31st, when the digital version is no longer available for sale and the physical version, you know,
is potentially long sold out.
What we suspect is going to happen is that those games will then be broken up and sold as individual digital copies
for $99.99. This isn't Reboot.
No.
Okay. All right. So no, we're on the same page about this. I think it's going to end up being $29.99.
I think so too. So what will end up happening though is I suspect that Super Mario Galaxy 2 will continue the Mario 35th anniversary. And it will be a release probably in some point next year.
Yeah.
And that will also be, look, if you're going to buy three games for $60, they're going to turn around and they're going to sell you the one that is, you know, critically.
That is critically better than all of them.
For that $30, probably. It'll be like, hey.
Or 40.
We know you missed this opportunity to buy these games. Now you can buy each of them individually for $29.99. And you can also buy Super Mario Galaxy 2.
Yeah.
And the one bone that they could throw people is they could either sell it alone or do some kind of discount where if you own the physical or digital All-Stars, they could turn around and be like, hey, you were smart to get in earlier. We're gonna give you a $10 discount. But this is Nintendo, so don't count.
Yeah, definitely don't ever count on that. All right, so we are going to take a quick break here.
Yep. But, and those were quick hits.
I still have to get used to him doing that. That's still new. I think I should just bake it into our show notes. Mike does singing thing.
All right, so we'll be back with Matt Piscatella in just a bit.
Virtual Economy is an F-Squared initiative. And along with pro bono business consulting for up-and-coming developers, it's a way we are working to give back to the community that has already given us so much. To find out more about F-Squared and the services we can provide, including pitch prep, media training, mock reviews, and business strategy guidance, visit our website at fsquared.biz.
And we are back. We have one big topic that has a lot of little topics. It's a topic duckin'.
No, don't say that.
We are so excited to be joined by NPD analyst Matt Piscatella, who's making a second appearance on the show. You were like our second guest, our third guest. Like you were there in week one, Matt.
Yeah, it was early days. It's fun being back. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
We're so glad to talk with you. For those of you who don't know Matt, he is a wizard. He is a genius. Mm. He is
true.
He is an authority on the video game market, especially in the United States. Matt's background. Matt, you were at Warner for a while. Where else were you?
I started at Activision Blizzard back in 2005. Working, my first game I worked on was Shrek 2 for the Nintendo GameCube.
Oh man!
Wow.
Yeah.
So Matt's back. We reached out to Matt because we knew we wanted to have this conversation. We're recording this. It is currently 1 p.m. Eastern on September 4th. You are listening to this as early as September 5th. And we do not have prices for the PlayStation 5, the Xbox Series X, and Microsoft still has not officially confirmed the Xbox Series S, which now we like all know is happening because of the leak we talked about earlier. The extra small. Because of the slip that somebody had packed in with their Xbox One controller, the leak of the Xbox Series X controllers that explicitly mentioned the Xbox Series S. But before we get into console pricing,
it's really important that we kind of set the stage and kind of broaden the picture just a little bit and talk about the fact that NVIDIA has announced the pricing and the specs on this 30 series card. So this will be their second series of cards that have ray tracing, which is important because both of the new consoles coming this fall, we still assume they're coming this fall. Mm-hmm. We don't have any reason to believe that they're not coming this fall, except for the fact that we don't know how much they're going to cost. Those consoles will have ray tracing. So Amanda, do you want to walk us really quickly through the NVIDIA stuff and then we can kind of put this all in context?
Yeah, absolutely. So well, let's talk a little bit about what's going on with NVIDIA announcing its new 30 series cards. So this pricing is really reasonable.
It is.
Like, shockingly reasonable if you don't understand the underpinnings of what's been going on with GPUs, but we'll get there. Buckle up. It's a conversation. And by conversation, I mean it's a very brief soundbite. So the 3070, which has 8 gigabytes of RAM, is going to be coming out at $499, but is more powerful than the 2080 Ti, which is available for $1,200.
I almost bought one of those, and then I ended up getting the 2070 Super kind of as a bridge between the 980 Ti that I had and knowing mm-hmm. that I was going to really want to more fully upgrade in the next series.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm rocking a 1080 Ti, which actually is still a really good card.
It is a very good card, yeah.
Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. The 1080 Ti is a beast.
It just doesn't have ray tracing.
It just doesn't have ray tracing. So the things that could be extremely pretty are just very pretty.
Mm-hmm.
So the 3080, which is probably what Mike and I are going to get because, of course, we are fabulously wealthy. Because we have blue check marks on Twitter. That means we're fabulously wealthy. The 3080
these are business. To be clear, hold on. These are business expenses because of the work.
Listen. Fabulously wealthy because of our blue check marks.
Yeah, okay. I'm on
The 3080 is going to be priced at $699 with 10 gigs of VRAM. And the absolutely bananas card, which is the 3090, is going to be priced at $1,499 with 24 gigabytes of dedicated VRAM.
And it takes up, and hold on, takes up three slots.
Takes up three slots. It would not fit in my system, by the way, because
I think it would barely fit in mine.
It would, well, in mine specifically, I'm using one of my PCI slots for PCIe slots, I guess, for my my capture card.
Oh, right.
Because I am a professional streamer now. I made $20 this month. That means I'm a professional. all of these are due out on the 17th. There will be likely overclocked third-party cards. The 3090 is the only one that supports SLI. How? I beg you, how? Where would you put the other card?
I don't know. Especially because, like, so the 3090 is apparently can do 8K 60 frames.
I cannot.
Now, I think that's with DLSS on.
It has to be.
Also, alongside that, a number of manufacturers have announced the new version, the new G-Sync monitors that go up to 360 hertz.
Whew. Okay. So all of this to say that everything is fairly reasonably priced. This is what I would have expected from the last generation and the generation before. However, because of the surge in cryptocurrency mining, a lot of those GPUs got inflated in price because they were so hard to find. These days, however, pricing is back to relatively middle ground because cryptocurrency and cryptocurrency mining has taken, to say it's taken a nosedive might be putting it lightly.
Although,
I mean,
good
it didn't
luck
get
finding a video card or anything these days. And Matt, were you talking about this on Twitter earlier about laptops?
Yeah, laptops today, but graphics cards as well. I was talking to Steve Baker, who was our analyst covering the PC space. And the signals and demand that he's seeing right now are that the graphics card market is going to become as hot or perhaps even hotter than the crypto bubble. So we're watching this stuff really closely. The demand for all things tech right now is so white hot. People had all this money they were putting into experiential spending, like going to concerts or going to sporting events or going on cruises or going anywhere, leaving their house. They used to be able, remember leaving your house? People could do that before, but now that they can't, they're putting all of their money into things like tech. And so we're just seeing white hot demand for graphics cards, PCs. I mean, you name it.
Wow. Because like I was thinking, we're thinking about upgrading next year, and who knows what things are going to look like next year. At the same time, like my processor and motherboard are 5 years old, so I'm looking at probably $1,500 in expense. Well, and I'll need RAM with the new motherboard, so I'm looking at about $1,500 in expense in order to upgrade my PC, because that's something that we want to budget for. Here's my segue. We want to budget for that. And part of budgeting for that is understanding how much our console investments are going to cost this fall. But we can't do that yet because it's September and we don't know console prices. Matt, what, why?
Yeah, we don't know console prices. We don't know console release dates. We don't know console launch slates. We don't know console associated services. We don't know how many consoles are going to be made. We don't know where you can buy them. We don't know how you're going to actually be able to pre-order them except for one website, which is really just allowing you to buy two cameras for one console. Why you're allowed to buy two cameras, who the hell knows?
That was so like, weird. We talked about that last
week.
We did. It was the weirdest thing. It's like, oh, you can buy two DualSense controllers. Okay. You can buy two media remotes. Okay.
Why?
You can buy two cameras. It's like,
why?
Multi-angle what? I don't...
Yeah, it's really crazy. The list of things we don't know for sure right now is quite long. And so, a personal problem. But when you're trying to put out predictions and forecasts and models about what this market might look like this year, and you don't know any of those things, you end up with the Excel sheets with like 24 different tabs of assumptions. It's really fun and kind of crazy. Yeah, we don't know. And it matters a lot, and yet it doesn't matter. It's 2020, man. Who knows?
So, I mean, let's kind of break that down a little bit. Because Amanda and I have talked about a lot of the reasons why it does matter. But I think hearing from your perspective, what are the reasons why it matters that we don't have pricing yet?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it matters for a number of reasons. And there are circumstances beyond the price that are impacted by the announcement that also come into play. I mean, obviously, consumers or people who are interested in buying these systems want to know how much they need to save, right? We have remarkable unemployment at the moment. We have a record number of folks out there who are food insecure. We have record lines at food banks, and 40% of the people using food banks have never used them before. We have vast uncertainty across just about every facet of life. And, people are still very interested in buying the new consoles, and they just kind of want to know how much they'll cost. So that's like the first breakdown, right? But what extends from not having the price and release date announcements is, it also puts retail in a pretty tough position. They want to make sure that they're planned appropriately and have pre-orders set up and have planning for, delivering product to people, whether in store or, through a delivery service. You go down the way, and then that extends even to game development, game production, where discs are going, where accessories are going. Like, so much kind of hinges on this timing and pricing announcement. Not having it is making some folks pretty nervous. Now, there are other categories where this isn't a thing, right? Like mobile phones. A new phone's announced, and it's announced, and it's out today, and here's the price. So it's not like, every electronic device needs to have the price announced 2 months early. However, in this space, it's a little bit different. And the norm is to have these details out a little bit earlier. But then that leads to where the first party console manufacturers are planning to sell and how they're planning to sell. And that's where things get really interesting.
Okay. So at this juncture, though, when we're looking ahead, and I think that all of those things are extremely valid. We talk about that all the time. You cannot have a conversation about pricing or a luxury hobby like gaming without acknowledging all of the very bad things going on in the world right now, especially in the United States. So we've talked about why this is concerning. Why isn't it concerning?
Well, it's not concerning because given the quantities that are available in a launch year or a launch calendar year, right, or the first holiday, you know, you're talking historically anywhere between 1.5 million to just under 4 million units of, you know, two platform new consoles will be available by the first holiday end. So, you know, with 311 million people in the U.S., and I mean in U.S. numbers here, and with 311 million people in the U.S., it literally is a one percenter issue, right? These boxes are going to go to those folks that have the means, have the income, have the dollars available and the time in order to buy them. So it doesn't matter because these things are going to sell out this holiday.
Yeah.
Where things get really dicey and where my eyes are is April of 2021. When the market is supposed to start rationing up to more of the mass consumer, where is the market at? Or how many units are sitting around on store shelves? How readily available are they? And how sensitive is pricing at that point? So it doesn't matter because they're going to sell out. And, you know, we have all of this hand-wringing and navel-gazing right now about, you know, how much these things are going to cost. But, you know, once they sell out on launch day, you know, you're going to have this immediate backlash of, see, all you people who you know, were worried about price, you don't have to worry about it. These things are super hot, whatever. But, you know, that's not the problem. The problem is Q2 2021.
Sure. I guess looking at this, it's like the Wii all over again and how that was 12 months of constrained supply.
Yeah, and on the opposite end, you had the Wii U where you had units available on launch day on shelf, right? And you have the balance is in the middle. You don't want to have it so that no one can buy your system, but you also don't want it to be too easy to buy it. There's a little bit of that scarcity and FOMO that drives, especially some, you know, spur of the moment purchase decision making. So
that's scarcity marketing is the thing for a reason. It's exactly. Psychologically effective.
Right. And so you want it to be just scarce enough. And plus, you know, no one likes to sit on really expensive units with low margin. They like to have those things move.
Yeah. The other question, and this kind of dovetails into the pricing conversation, is we've seen Microsoft especially, you know, talk about how you can take your accessories forward. There was just, the latest volley of that was, hey, we mentioned this, but now we are putting some shape around it. Anything that is made for Xbox. So Astro just came out and explained how you're going to use all of your headsets on both next-gen consoles. But Microsoft specifically, they're like, hey, you can take your Xbox One controllers and your Xbox Elite controllers and anything that we've put out, and you can use that right on the Xbox One X. Sony, on the other hand, has said, so your DualSense controller will work, or your DualShock 4 controller will work on the PS5, but only for the PS4 games. And your camera will work, but only for the VR stuff that it needs to work with. And your Move controllers only work with VR. When people are looking at that, given that this is relatively new, that your controllers can come forward, for instance, is that going to be a consideration for people, do you think, when evaluating price? Do people just look at the console price tag, or do they actually think about the bottom line price tag when they're thinking about purchasing a new console?
So the ultra core, super into it, following people like us on Twitter, like really getting into the price point shifting, those people are going to know about it. But those people are also going to be the ones who go out and buy all the new stuff anyway, because they have to have the new stuff. The general mass market consumer, the person who's like, oh yeah, I hear there's a new Xbox out, I want to play Call of Duty. They'll have no idea. They won't care. They'll buy a couple extra new controllers to go with a new box because they won't know their old ones can work with a new one. So ultimately, I don't think it matters. The mass market consumer is going to buy the new stuff because it's on the shelf and pretty next to the new console. Or, you know, it's like, hey, add this to your cart too online. But it does. It is messaging for that very core community who then influences their friends and family purchase decision making. And so, you know, if you have, if a real core console enthusiast says, hey, the Xbox Series X, I'm able to bring my stuff forward. Xbox Game Pass is really good value. Hey, friends and family, you should probably get a Series X. Whereas, you know, the PlayStation 5 core enthusiast is going to say, hey, there's going to be single player narrative experiences that will only be available here. These are the best games. Friends and family, go pick up this. So it's cool messaging. It's good differentiation. It certainly shows that there is more than one way to go to market. But ultimately, like backwards compatibility, which is also a really cool feature to chat about, but not used as much as some would think. It's a nice messaging material, but I don't know how ultimately impactful it'll be on the market.
I mean, that makes sense. It's not surprising to me that those of us that are extremely online, hashtag online all the time, get into these discussions. But the vast majority of the folks that I know, so if we think about like our parent friends that are going to go out and purchase a new console at some point over the next 12 to 18 months, they don't care about any of that. They're like, I don't know, my kid wants this thing. Is that which console is the one I should get? That's going to, oh my gosh, I just thought of that. I just thought that's going to be the question I'm going to be asked so much over the next couple of years.
Oh yeah, you're doomed.
I'm doomed. All my mom friends are going to ask me that. Okay, so I speaking of being extremely online and being connected to the game industry, you know, I want to dig into your perspective on this. Like, what kind of effect are we going to see this launch cycle and how kind of obtuse the pricing has been and potentially access to dev kits have been? What kind of effect is this going to have on games going forward, specifically like the indie games that, you know, need more time and don't necessarily have a ton of money to invest in next gen tech right out of the gate?
Right. I mean, right now, uncertainty and chaos reign.
That's a mood.
It's any assumption that anyone makes right now is bound to be incorrect. All of the uncertainty around these systems is just adding more uncertainty to what's already really uncertain, right? So right. how it's all gonna end up flowing out is, I mean, anyone's guess right now. Everything is harder though when information and details and things like that are unavailable. It makes planning, or at least trying to plan, more difficult. And the last thing that anyone really needs in 2020 in game development is more difficulty. Things are hard enough as they are. So it is pretty challenging now. Like, what the default might be is the PC is still a very indie-friendly development platform, yeah, although there are challenges around just the sheer number of releases coming out and being drowned in them. And the Switch continues to be a very indie-friendly platform, although it is also having its challenges with discoverability, particularly around the indie titles. So maybe we'll just have to see how it develops. I mean, the one certainty in the console space for the indie market is Xbox Game Pass, and having some certainty around your return that you'll get from an investment from Microsoft being put onto the service. So there, at least there's something there that you can rely on if you sign a deal with Xbox Game Pass. But if you don't, then, you know, you're taking some risks trying to develop for the next gen systems. You're going after what you'll, you know, an unknown market size, but you're hoping to be one of the relatively big fish in a small pond of available titles. So there's a, you know, there's a risk reward ratio there that every developer and publisher has to weigh out. But you know, in general, shoot, man, not knowing all this stuff, it makes things extremely difficult.
Chaos reigns.
Yeah,
seriously,
it's wild. You know, and there's another factor here as well. When Microsoft went to market with the Xbox One, there was a single Xbox One unit. When Sony went to market with the PlayStation 4, there was a single PlayStation 4 unit. Now, Microsoft has split in the past. There was the Xbox 360, I think, launched with two different versions. And the PlayStation 3 launched with two different versions. But here we are now with what seems like both Sony and Microsoft are going to be launching with two different versions of their consoles. Again, we don't know what the Xbox Series S does because it hasn't been officially announced, although it's been leaked up one side and down the other. And, you know, on the PlayStation side, you're asking people, it's like, okay, well, if you have a library of PlayStation 4 games and, you know, all that's available is the digital version, what decision you're going to make. So what, especially given everything we know about the pandemic and how that's impacted literally everything,
how is splitting the production lines going to impact this rollout, do you think?
Well, I mean, you certainly have to make a bet, right? You have so much production capacity. You're trying to push as much production out as you can for a holiday release. You know, Sony's been out there talking about how they've increased their production for the PlayStation 5 to an unknown unit number. But you do have to make a bet, right? You have to say, we're going to make this percent of this version and that percent of another version. Now, in the holiday period, it's probably not a big deal. If you go to a store, you go online, and one of the versions is sold out, you know, you might default to picking up the other if you're on PlayStation in particular. On the Xbox, it could get a little more difficult depending on what the Series S actually ends up being versus all of the rumors. You know, and but it's hard to get a real strong signal of demand that way. It's really hard to figure out that right mix. So, you know, it could end up being where it's fine and people just pick the one or the other depending on what's available. Or, you know, you could lead to a lot of disappointed folks. Now, the worst case scenario is if, you know, one of the boxes has a, say, $600 version and a $400 version, but they make too many of the $600 versions and they don't sell quite as well as they thought, and the $400 version is sold out everywhere. You know, that leads to some you know, tough conversations around missed opportunities. So it all this just makes everything a bit more challenging for the end consumer, particularly the ones who are not super invested in knowing every single detail about the space and just want to play the new Madden or the new Call of Duty, or they, hey, my kid wants to play Fortnite and he says, I need to get the new box, right? It makes it very difficult for those.
It's not on iOS anymore, so.
What's that?
Because it's not on iOS anymore, so.
Right, you know, well, okay, that going back to the battle of margins, right? If you want to talk about margins, we could go all day. So that makes it tough, and it just adds another layer for folks to try to figure out. You know, they're like, I just want the new box. I don't know. What am I? With S, X, what? Who? So yeah, it's going to be interesting to see that play out.
Well, and that kind of mindset is also why we're seeing folks looking more avidly at using their PCs, where they're just like, okay, I don't want to screw around with all of this split production nonsense. I just want to play games. So what if I just get a new video card and slap it in my system that is relatively decent, and look at me, I have something that is akin to a console. And as a PC gamer, I have been a PC gamer my whole life. That's almost always been my approach to gaming anyway. It's like, okay, well, I'm going to play it on a PC more than likely. That's just where I'm going to go. But let's talk a little bit about the GPU pricing and how that might impact consoles.
Right. So, okay. So first of all, how messed up is 2020 when when the idea of PC gaming might be simpler than buying a console? Like, what is even happening?
Yeah, what is happening here? PC gaming is extremely complicated. Do you remember back in the freaking 90s where we were screwing around with INI files and registries and trying to get things to work when they were so deeply broken, and you got an install and you're like, why doesn't this work? And now I have to have a no CD key because I lost the damn CD, or it's cracked, or what? It just, PC gaming has been complicated forever. What is happening?
Yeah, motherboard jumpers. I always had a lot of fun with motherboard jumpers.
Oh my gosh.
But I built my first PC in like 1996. So like, I'm talking old school here. Anyway, in the US there are 108 million active console gamers in the US. 69% of those 108 million also play PC games. The people that play console games who also play PC games, they spend about 6 hours a week playing PC and about 10 hours a week playing console. So we have the majority of console gamers today are also PC game players. Now, they play more heavily on the console, but they're still playing PC. So the idea of some of those folks just saying, you know what, I'm going to hold off on consoles. I'm going to, you know, play my PC. I'm going to get a new graphics card and hold off on the console bit. You know, that's a real potential threat that could actually happen. Some people doing that. I don't know how many. But you know, the days of a console gamer is a very different person than a PC gamer, who's very different than like a mobile player. Those days are over. Like, there is so much cross play between platforms that, you know, it wouldn't be surprising to see some people shift a majority of their play time across device types, depending on what makes it easy. And of course, with cloud on the way, and xCloud in particular, there's even more likelihood of people deciding that, hey, you know what? I'm having a good time playing xCloud with my Razer Kishi on my mobile phone. So I'm going to do that primarily. And is that person a console gamer? Are they a mobile gamer? Like, what are they? Well, it turns out that they're just a person who plays games, and the platform delineations don't really matter as much. So that's kind of where we're heading to. Yeah, that's kind of where we're heading to. And when you see these, and when you see the graphics card prices come out and they're that reasonable for, like, I'm running a 2080 Super, and the mid-range new NVIDIA card is going to blow what I have out of the water at a relatively low price. Like, I'm even thinking about, man, maybe I should do that first, because...
Well, I mean, I got to tell you, after what you said about potential constrained supply on the GPU side of things, we were thinking about holding off on the 3080s, and now it's like, I just put in a little notify me when available on the GeForce site, because I'm thinking... maybe we should do that now, and I'll just do my processor and motherboard next year. That I can do whenever. But let's get those in the door, and I'd be upgrading from a 2070 Super, and like, I'm sure you've taken a look at the ray tracing stuff, and it's like proof of concept on the 20 series, and I think it's going to come into its own on the 30 series.
Yeah, I bought a 2080 Super, and all I've really done with it for ray tracing is play through Control. So, like, Control, playing Control has cost me about $1,700 across everything I had to buy to get my rig for ray tracing. So I'm kind of like,
well, what's the difference? If you want to play it on next gen, you got to buy the Ultimate Edition.
you're right.
The 505 conversation right now. We already did that.
Oh, yeah. I do want to say, hold on. Can I just really, really, just really quickly throw this in there, since we just were on the topic? CD Projekt announced today that Witcher 3, if you have it on PC, PS4, or Xbox One, they are going to be releasing next gen version on consoles and a refined version with updated visuals on PC, 100% free.
That kind of fits their MO. That's their deal. It always kind of has been, which is it's cool. It's very consumer.
But it's really a thumb in the eye for 505.
Yeah, I mean, comparing well, let's just say that The Witcher sold a few more units. So
yes, that's true.
But yeah, so like, we talk about the ray tracing stuff, you're absolutely right. The 2080 series was really like, hey, the first foray into ray tracing, only a few games really took advantage of it. Now that ray tracing has come to consoles and is going to be a very, you know, big part of the 30 series, ray tracing has become a much bigger deal. It's going to become more of a mainline thing. Do I wish I didn't spend $1,700 on a 2080 Super and associated processor and memory and motherboard to play Control? Probably. But hey, you know, I'm a professional. I guess I can write off the expense or something.
Exactly.
Fabulously wealthy.
I don't have a blue check mark though, so I don't know.
Okay, so you're not fabulously wealthy.
You will have one day, I predict.
I hope not, but maybe.
I hope not.
People get weird about that, man.
Like, they do.
I'm going to hit up Verified right now and be like, yo, what's up with Matt Piscitello? Why isn't he Verified?
I don't know. Twitter's creepy enough.
It really is. All right. So last question, and this kind of takes us again, kind of this full circle into PC town. Sony recently reaffirmed that it wants to bring more of its games to PC. Obviously, Microsoft has been doing that in a huge way. First with Play Anywhere, and then with Game Pass, and then Game Pass Ultimate. Now Sony moving in that direction, how does that change the conversation? I mean, obviously you have the fanboys who are like, oh, you're bringing our games to PC, what are you doing? And everybody else is like, okay, this makes a lot of sense. But in terms of purchasing new consoles, do you see the PC and the Game Pass Ultimate conversation impacting the Xbox Series X conversation? And if so, how do you see this potentially impacting the PlayStation 5 conversation?
Yeah, so the PC thing is interesting. Like, the console manufacturers know that the other folks are playing across both PCs and consoles. They know that just because you put your game on PC, basically if you put your game on PC, it has no impact to the sales of the console version of the game. Same the other way around. Like, they're complementary markets in many ways. Xbox makes it a little bit easier with Play Anywhere in particular, which lets lets people just go whatever device they want. PlayStation has been doing that for a while too via PlayStation Now for subscribers, although not quite as elegantly, and certainly can't get your save states across in some cases. But like they've both been toying with, you know, this kind of multi-pronged approach to the market. You do have your ultra core console focused folks who are gonna get mad about it online, but that's such a small percentage. And ultimately, you can't see any impact from those folks in the sales data. Certainly, I expect more of this type of thing. I expect more, particularly as cloud gets bigger and bigger over the next, say, 5 to 10 years, more ability to play content wherever you might be. There are very distinct benefits to having a dedicated gaming device via television, a big screen television. People like big, shiny, big screen TVs, and they like new, shiny consoles, and that's not going to change anytime soon. And it's just going to be about the best device to experience the content wherever and whenever someone might want to play. And that's ultimately what's going to drive everything else. And, you know, the real interesting bits are going to be about how game companies continue to do that and take away share of entertainment time from other mediums like television or movies or books or anything like that, and continue to become more available, because the more gaming is accessible, the bigger the market gets, and that's showing no signs at all of slowing down anytime soon.
And that is an amazing place for us to wrap this conversation. Matt, as always, thank you so much. This has been episode, hold on, I gotta scroll to the top of the show notes.
It's 44.
44, episode 44 of the Virtual Economy Podcast. You can follow us on Twitter at Virtual EconCast. I am at Footerish, FUTTERISH.
And I'm at Amanda Farrow, and I will never spell that out.
Ah, Matt, where can people find you on Twitter, which is a hellscape?
Yeah, at Matt Piscatella with one T, because it was the 70s, man, and my mom might have had some drugs before she, you know, and then she signed the birth certificate, misspelled my name. It's, what are you going to do, man? Like, it was the 70s.
It's all right. My dad's middle name is Niall.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Niall's a cool name. Like, he could be in like a band, like a British pop band or something.
Yeah. He's a short Jewish dude.
That's cool, man.
Let's
do some yacht rock. Let's make it happen. Jewish yacht rock. We can. Let's do it.
I'm 100% here for this entire thing. And if this is in fact your first foray with Virtual Economy, welcome to our weird little squad. You can subscribe to our RSS feed at virtualeconomy.libsyn. That's libsyn.com/RSS. You can listen to us on all major podcast platforms. We're pretty sure we're everywhere except for iHeartRadio, although we might even be there. I haven't checked in like a month.
Otherwise, I've broken iHeartRadio.
Aw, sadness. Oh, now I don't want to check. It's Schrodinger's radio now.
No, I'm looking.
I'm just no looking. We're not going to look now. You'll have to tell us. We're not going to look. So you can listen to us on places like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, Pocket Casts, Pocket Sand.
Pocket Sand.
It's funny. It's funnier now because we talked about Pocket Sand with Nikita.
It is.
On our last episode. So that's good stuff. So if you can, and if you are so inclined, please subscribe and let the algorithm gods know that we are, in fact, very special and that we are worthy of love and attention from the algorithm gods. And if possible, review the show. We always love hearing from our audience, from our listeners. And if you have any questions for us, you can DM us at @virtualeconcast, or you can send them to us at podcast@fsquared.biz. If you are not comfortable talking with us on Twitter or sending us an email, you can always DM @virtualeconcast and ask for our signal. I have a signal number. Mike has a signal number.
Yep.
You can talk to either of us. and it'll be good to go.
Yeah. And that wraps up words are things. That wraps up episode 44. We will be back next week. I'm making the executive decision that we are not going to have a Wednesday show next week. Our kids are back at school. I'm making the smart mental health choice for both of us. But we will be back with a new show next week that will air on Saturday. And in the meantime, wash your hands, stay hydrated, and be good to one another.
We'll see you soon.